Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Nighttime bedwetting, sometimes referred to as enuresis, is very common in childhood. It's estimated that it affects about 1 in 5-year-olds, often boys more than girls, and can continue into adolescence and rarely even into adulthood. Today we are discussing this common but somewhat frustrating problem with Anchorage pediatric urologist Dr. Lori Merriman. If you have any questions or comments during the next program, and you're in Anchorage, our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. We also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Laura, it's nice to have you here.
Thank you.
I often do a short introduction, but let's start today's program. Let you tell us a little bit about your training, yourself, and what brought you to Alaska.
Sure. Well, I'm originally from Texas. I haven't been back to Texas in a while, but I did my college and my medical school in Texas at Texas A&M and Texas Tech. From there, I actually went to Baltimore, where I did my surgical internship. And it's HOMA shock trauma, so it was a very interesting intern year. And then I went on to do my urologic training at University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. So as a urologist, we do our adult urology first for a total of 5 years, and then do additional training in pediatric urology, which I did an additional 2 years down in Atlanta at Emory.
And then you came up here a year ago straight from Emory?
Yep, straight from Emory. So we were looking at places that we wanted to go and thinking about where I'd want to work. One of my biggest wants for when I found my career was that I needed to go where I was needed. Mm-hmm. And I talked with my now partner and to see if he needed any help up here. He said he did. My husband and I are ecstatic to be here in Alaska, and we're here for good. So,
okay. And you are currently with Alaska Urology.
That's correct.
And we've got a link to Dr. Merriman's website and her office on our website at www.alaskapublic.org, and then you can go to the Line One website. All right, so our topic is enuresis. So a reasonable place to start would be to kind of somewhat get a definition of what we're talking about.
Sure. So enuresis, most simply put, is an involuntary discharge of urine, usually at nighttime. So we usually tag that with nocturnal, meaning night. Daytime or diurnal enuresis indicates a daytime incontinence.
And so we're talking about involuntary loss of urine control day or night. And I would like to, this is tough, always when I ask guests to do this, is kind of somewhat paint a picture of the physiology, the bladder, the anatomy, everything, so we can get an idea of the control of urine. Mm-hmm. And I want to point out again, if people want to know more, there are two short videos, one a little bit more complex than the other, discussing what Dr. Merriman is about to try to paint a picture of us.
Sure.
For. So how does all this plumbing work?
Oh, it's very important too. One of the biggest issues and one of the biggest things that I emphasize to patients and their families is that they need some knowledge about why this is happening. And my patients and families know that I'm a bit of an interpretive dancer. I draw because medical literacy is very important to me. But so it's very important to kind of think about the entire cycle of voiding. You know, your kidneys make urine. They send it down to the bladder. And as your bladder fills, there's a certain trigger, like a stretch receptor, that sends that signal that, you know, my bladder is full. I need to go to the bathroom. So that signal goes up to the brain. And your brain interprets it in the context of what's going on. You know, is the bathroom right across the hallway? Or am I in the movie theater and I'm in the middle of the movie and I really don't want to go? And so that gets interpreted by your frontal lobes. It gets sent down to your brainstem, the pontine micturition center, and that's literally like an on-off switch. I mean, you can really think of it as off and on. And it sends that appropriate signal down to your bladder saying, okay, you're good to go. Here's the thing about wetting and incontinence, and especially nighttime wetting, is that sometimes we don't gate through that on-off switch, okay? Your bladder muscle is not controlled by your brain at all. So when you sit down to go to the bathroom, you don't go, okay, bladder squeeze, like you're doing a bicep curl or anything. Your bladder is actually controlled by your spinal cord, okay? And that's what that on-off switch is controlling, is that reflex of your spinal cord. And I demonstrate that to patients by just doing the simple knee reflex. You know, I can lift my leg because my brain is telling my leg to lift, but if I hit a certain spot on my knee, my leg kicks up. Right. And your bladder is the same way. Right. So I tell parents that what's happening is the same exact thing that happened since you were a baby. Babies don't go, okay, do I have a diaper on? I can go ahead and go to the bathroom now. Babies don't care because the bladder fills and it empties by a spinal reflex. So, and that really goes into part of the potential etiologies of nighttime and daytime wetting, mm-hmm. about those sensory perceptions.
Yeah, so understanding the complexity of this leads us, it basically, like anything, once you understand the circuit, so to speak, problems can go awry throughout the whole circuit.
Right.
And
you know,
trying to figure out where the problem is, and it could be at multiple places in the
exactly.
circuit.
Exactly. You know, sometimes, you know, even my patients think, you know, man, there's just something, you know, I'm just not getting it. There's something wrong with me. But there's right. something, your bladder right. is happy because it's fulfilling. It's one of two functions, mm-hmm. and it's only two functions in life, right? To fill and to empty. And so when I have a teenager who has a nocturnal enuresis or nighttime bedwetting, I tell them that the reason why they still have it is because their bladder is fulfilling its job. Mm-hmm. Your brain is unhappy, but your bladder is mm-hmm. perfectly ecstatic.
I'm going to throw in just a little bit of anatomy and hope I don't get myself in too deep of water. The way I remember things is what Dr. Merriman is talking about. There's actually three kinds of muscle in our body. There's skeletal muscle, which is under voluntary control, as you said, mm-hmm. when you say, I'm going to move my leg. Then we have a lot of smooth muscle hanging around that's in pretty much involuntary control. Those are things that cause the bladder and then the smooth muscle in the lungs. But then you have another kind of one of the differences between the two is the skeletal muscle can fatigue as well as being under control, whereas smooth muscles don't fatigue and are not under voluntary control. Then you have heart muscle, which also has its own rhythm, so to speak, its own rhythmicity. So there's actually three kinds of muscle, as well as all being attached to the nervous system in some complex ways.
Mm-hmm.
How about maturation? Obviously, a newborn baby, his nervous system is continuing to develop. We now know the frontal lobes, even in humans, are not completely developed well into adolescence and early adulthood. So there must be some changes going on during these first several years that help us learn to control these reflexes, so to speak.
Absolutely. So the bladder itself continues to mature from infancy through 2 years of age. A lot of parents like to ask, when could I expect my child to have grown out of this? And the answer is quite complex because, as you said, we do know that the brain continues to mature through adolescence and into early adulthood. And anybody who's basically taught their child how to recognize full bladder signals know how difficult it is. You know, potty training is something that we do by relation, by trying to get the child to recognize that their bladder is full and that they need to go to a socially acceptable location to pee. But trying to communicate the sensation of, you know, this is when your bladder is full is quite difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that they will have to learn over time and learn to interpret. But, you know, if somebody comes in with, say, a four-year-old who complains that their child is still wetting at night, I still, you know, give them recommendations. I don't necessarily say, you know, your child will expect to grow out of it, because establishment of good voiding habits is very important, even early.
Mm-hmm. Let me take just a second to remind listeners, this is Line 1, Your Health Connection, originating from Anchorage, Alaska on KSKA. Our topic today is urinary incontinence, also at times referred to as enuresis, particularly nocturnal enuresis, where there's bedwetting at night. My guest is Anchorage pediatric urologist Dr. Laura Merriman. If you've got questions or comments during the next hour or so, let me give you a couple of numbers and an email address to contact us. This would be a good time to call and get get your questions and concerns addressed. In Anchorage, it's 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and the email address is line1, and you have to spell that out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at alaskapublic.org. So let's talk about the epidemiology a little bit. If we were going to talk about nocturnal enuresis, who does it? Which sex? You know, what age? What's the situation?
Well, it's definitely more prevalent in boys than girls, at a ratio of about 3 to 2. There are a lot of different statistics out there about what we could expect for certain age groups. About 5% of children between the ages of 6 and 7 years will have an episode of nighttime wetting. For children who are a little bit older, about 7% of boys age 9 and about 6% of boys of age 10. In girls, it's a little bit lower, so about 6% of girls age 7 or 9, I'm sorry, and about 3% of girls age 10. So it does decrease as you get older. The current dogma is that you will have an improvement over the year in about 15% of children, okay? The thing about statistics, though, and one of the reasons why I don't typically quote statistics to my patients is that, one, it's hard for them to know what it means to them. You know, are they going to be one of the 15% that's going to improve over the year? You know, if they were, then why would they be seeing me, you know? Medical numeracy is sometimes a hard concept to really apply to yourself. The other thing is that the International Children's Continence Society deemed that natural history studies in nocturnal enuresis are now unethical. And so what that means is that instead of managing children, we take a group of children and we just see what happens. And we see how many children will just resolve without any sort of intervention or any sort of treatment or management. But because the toll on a child's self-esteem, the psychological toll, that it's no longer considered appropriate to just wait. Mm-hmm. It's more appropriate because there's so many conservative measures and easy things that you can do to try and fix this.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So it's we no longer have that ability to see what happens over time, what we would call the natural history of untreated enuresis. The numbers and what we have is based on some information in the past, which may also be biased in some ways.
Right.
But in general, things get better with time. And I see that there is a phone call that came in on adult bedwetting. So I'm going to go ahead and take that call and suggest that sometimes it can continue into adulthood. Oh, okay. So the person with that just hung up. So that leads to my question is, I've been in practice over 30 years in pediatrics, and I can only recall a handful of adolescents. And again, I have a selection bias in that there's times when patients never tell me that there's still bedwetting going on. So I'm only talking about the really recalcitrant, the kids that are parents who brought it up to me. And they can be pretty difficult. So it does continue into adulthood at times.
It does, yeah. It can. You know, I tell parents that we talked about a little bit about the physiology and how since the bladder is emptying by that spinal reflex, it does not need the brain in order to trigger an emptying cycle. And because the bladder is fulfilling those goals to fill and to empty, I explain to patients and to parents that it can be akin to pushing a cart down a dirt path. You know, you push that cart down there so many times and so often, it gets so rutted, it is really tough to lift that cart out of that path. That even children who come see me when they're younger, I advise parents that it can take up to 6 months to have any sort of discernible improvement, even if they're doing all the modifications that I talk about, improved voiding habits, even if they're doing everything right, it can take a while because that nervous system loop is really a vicious cycle. Mm-hmm. And it's sometimes very hard to break.
Mm-hmm. Does the cycle that's from the spinal cord, does it get, in a sense, sensitized itself to? Is that, I don't know if that's the right term, increased sensitivity?
Well, I think it's because it's not gated.
Okay.
You know, because the pontine micturition center is what is gating it, that on-off switch in your brainstem. And because it's not being modulated in any way, it's doing exactly what it wants to do. As soon as your bladder breaks a threshold of volume, that, you know, your bladder could be really full before you get a signal to your brain saying, I've really got to go. My bladder may be half as full, you know, before I get a signal to my brain, I really got to go. But those signals aren't being sent because either the bladder's been ignored for so long or it's just not being gated at all. Which is actually really interesting because children with ADHD have a lot of the same issues, even without nocturnal enuresis, with gating through the brainstem.
Which brings up the child who again, I'm maybe making this more complicated than it seems, but there's the kid who you hear about with daytime wetting who just doesn't want to stop what they're doing, and it made me think about the ADD, ADHD. Is I'm engaged, I'm moving around, I'm moving all the time, and I'm insatiable in the sense I don't want to stop, which is part of what's ADD, ADHD. So those kids are stretching their bladder increasingly, and eventually they're going to have to do something about it.
Holding maneuvers during the daytime are a really big deal. I guess one of the things that touch on as far as nocturnal enuresis is I always check to see if they have any daytime symptoms as well, you know, because I really treat them both completely separately. And if a child has daytime symptoms, meaning urgency, got to go to the bathroom a lot, frequency, physically going to the bathroom a lot, or incontinence, I always focus on the daytime first because a lot of times good voiding habits during the day can translate over into the nighttime. And you're right on, you know, kids who get very distracted, kids who are not paying attention to those full bladder signals, after a certain point, their bladder is going to say, you know what, brain, you're not even listening to me, so I'm going to do what I have always done, which is empty. And a lot of times they'll empty almost to completion.
This is somewhat off the subject, but there's always this interplay between the psychosocial, mental health kinds of aspects. I had a mother in recently who had a child who I've seen oftentimes kids probably 3, 4, maybe 4, 5, and 6, maybe boys more than girls, although it happened in my family as well. They seem like they have to go to every bathroom that's even nearby, which is really nothing other than it seems like it's not frequency, urgency. It's not just small amounts of frequency. They just, which can be confusing to families, though, because they have to run to the restroom all the time. Let's get back to what we've been talking about a little bit, this nocturnal enuresis. Are there risk factors? Are there things that make you want to ask about when you're seeing these kinds of patients?
You know, family history. Family history is pretty big. There might be a genetic component to it, and that may relate to one of the other etiologic causes of nocturnal enuresis, which is a nocturnal polyuria, which means that you just tend to make more urine at night. And we can talk about that in a bit. Basically, if both parents had an issue with nighttime wetting, then 70% of their children will have the same issue. If one parent has nighttime wetting, then 40% of their children will have the same issue. And if you are a twin, an identical twin, then the concordance rate, or the rate of the both twins having the same issue, is 68%. You know, so there's a definite genetic link to this. The other thing I always ask about is I always ask about psychological stressors, because that is a really big deal. The urinary tract loves to concentrate stress. It really does. And it's, as you can imagine, it's a vicious cycle. You know, you wet, you get stressed out, you wet more. I see a lot of kids at the beginning of the school year. I see a lot of kids at the end of the school year because of exams. I do ask if there's anything stressing them out, or at least tell them that there are certain things that may trigger them into a wetting episode, you know, and they just have to be like, you know, the proverbial duck, you know, let the water roll off the back and you know, pick up the pieces and continue with the program, basically. There are other things related to the nocturnal polyuria, you know, an insufficient production of antidiuretic hormone. So you're not making enough hormone in order to modulate your water balance appropriately. That's a little bit harder to discover. You would have to have the child have a very good voiding diary and also basically urinate into a hat or record the volumes of urination, which is a lot to ask of a family.
So that hormone, in a sense, is kind of our adaption to sleep at night. So we try not to make as much urine so we don't have to get up out of sleep. That's how I'm thinking about
right,
it,
right.
If that's fair to say.
Yeah.
So there's kids who don't quite make enough of that, so they may have more urine at night.
Right.
What you're saying.
Yeah. Nobody really knows exactly why or how they do that. It could be the way they handle, solutes or electrolytes in their body. Their kidneys just tend to want to make more urine at night. Nobody really knows. But I usually talk to parents when I talk about fluid modulation throughout the day. That, a lot of times children will go through their school day, say, and they won't drink hardly anything. They may drink a little bit of water or juice for breakfast, maybe their Capri Sun for lunch, and then nothing after that. So I always ask them if they're thirsty when they get home. And then they drink a few glasses of water, then they drink water, juice, tea, soda, milk for dinner, and then they go to bed, you know? And so you think about it, two-thirds of their day, they've hardly drink anything, and the last third of their day they're gaining all their fluid intake, and then their kidneys, when they lay down, are thinking, man, I'm not running a marathon right now, I don't need all this water, so I'm going to dump it all in the bladder. And then all of a sudden you're basically behaviorally inducing nocturnal polyuria without a physical defect.
And I want to briefly just bring up the issue of caffeine, which is in colas as well as tea. Probably we're not in the coffee drinking crowd. How does caffeine act on the urinary system?
It's a diuretic. it makes you have to go pee. So it's a lot of times, it's funny, caffeine can be a very excellent diagnostic instrument for urologists sometimes. But I've had patients when I was in Atlanta that complain of nocturnal enuresis and come to find out that their child is drinking cans of soda and hiding them in the closet. So, that's a very easy fix.
We have come up almost to half time of the program already, and I want to go over the various causes and carefully, and then talk about treatments based on those causes. So before we make this leap and answer one of my emails, which is asking that very question, I want to go ahead and take our break at this particular time. I want to remind listeners that you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number, again, is 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and our email address line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a very short break, and then we'll continue our discussion on urinary incontinence or bedwetting with Dr. Laura Merriman. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Anchorage pediatric urologist, Dr. Laura Merriman, and we're discussing bedwetting, urinary incontinence in children. Up to this point, we've really, to a large degree, talked about how the urinary system works and how it's influenced and what are the factors that guide our ability to control our urine. And we're going to spend the rest of this time talking about the problems that cause this this disorder and the treatment options that are available. So if you have if you have any questions or comments, you can email those to line1@alaskapublic.org. Our local number again, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And as the usual reminder, if you're listening between 9 and 10 p.m. on KSK on Monday evenings, you're listening to a taped rebroadcast, and we will not be able to address your calls. Also, as a reminder, you can come to our station by internet at any time and find the Line 1 link at alaskapublic.org and listen to our archives, or find our archives and listen to the program or refer somebody to those. And also, you can find the program listed in the podcast at iTunes. So we've talked a little bit about the anatomy and physiology. What are the principal causes that you're thinking of? And this may lead to some physical exam. We've talked about history a little bit, that you're thinking about as you see someone who comes in with some complaint of enuresis.
So the primary causes that we had talked about, usually there's two schools of thought about what causes nocturnal enuresis, and that's that nocturnal polyuria. And the second is that the bladder is not responding to signals from the brain, or is not being gated through the brainstem. There's a third theory that the functional capacity of the bladder is smaller. And what I mean by that is I mean that the physical capacity is not smaller, because it's very hard for you to truly have a small bladder. I know it's something that people complain about a lot, but what's really happening is really the strength of the signals that are being sent to your brain. But the functional capacity is smaller, meaning that that's the amount of fluid you can have in your bladder before you get those signals to your brain saying, I need to go to the bathroom. Back in the 1960s and 1970s, one of the management strategies for that was to teach children to hold their urine, which is not something a lot of pediatricians or urologists recommend anymore, you know, because that's actually does more harm than good. That nowadays we recognize that that's not a viable strategy. But there have been papers back in the 1960s saying that, you know, you should teach your children to hold their urine as long as possible to try and make their bladders bigger, which is not necessarily possible. As far as the exam is concerned, physically, there's not very many causes of incontinence that crop up. About 98% of kids who come to see me for daytime or nighttime incontinence don't have any definable organic cause. That doesn't mean I don't look, though. You know, so there's I always do basically a spot neurologic assessment. I watch the child walk in the room. I see how they climb up on the exam table if they're old enough. I look to see if there's a sacral dimple on their back, which could indicate a lower spinal cord issue, which can cause neurologic problems with the bladder, which can affect emptying and continence. Also look for anatomic abnormalities. Very rarely will a child have, say, like the ureter, which is the tube that drains the kidney down to the bladder, plugged into the wrong spot. Very classically in little girls, if it's plugged into the urethra, then they will be incontinent 24 hours a day, because basically the kidneys are draining straight to the outside world. Mm-hmm. Pretty rarely does that occur. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, you know, healthcare dollars and everything like that. Nowadays, I don't necessarily evaluate every single child with a renal and bladder ultrasound, but kids who are refractory to treatment, who are basically doing everything right, then I do evaluate them with a renal and bladder ultrasound, and to make sure that their bladder is emptying appropriately.
It's not uncommon for pediatricians, I'm sure urologists, to have parents come in who have children with enuresis who say, my kid says, I just can't feel that. Mm-hmm. And there are, I often will, at least in boys, will do a scrotal reflex. You can actually stroke the inner upper thigh and see the scrotum move a little bit, which I was taught gives me pretty good indication that the nervous system is in function. Is that fair to say?
Yep, that's the cremasteric reflex.
Okay.
We do that, and we also check the tone of the anal sphincter, because that gives us a good idea to see how well the pelvic floor is working. Because you think about the organs of continence, and it's not just the bladder, but it's also the pelvic floor, which is the hammock of muscle that supports your bladder and your rectum, as well as the rectum. You know, you might not think that the rectum would have a whole lot to do with your continence, but it does, because the pelvic nerves that are around there affect both the rectum and the bladder, because they both have the same two jobs, which are to fill and to empty. Mm-hmm. So they can definitely affect each other.
Mm-hmm. It It's funny that you mentioned the lower bladder size. I mean, there's no question I went through a period, probably back in training, I can't remember, but you still see that written about in the pediatric literature. And that just never seemed to really resonate with me very well on history. And so my bias has become is more of a sleep-like disorder, because so often, if not always, I get a history of the kids who do this, and I'd have to say it's often boys, maybe more than the 3 to 2 that you talked about, are very, very, very deep sleepers, mm-hmm. notoriously hard to arouse. However, I don't know. I'm not seeing kids who are deep sleepers who do not have bedwetting problems. So I'm biased, and I'm certainly not doing any research. Is that make sense to you?
Oh, it absolutely does. That is definitely another thing to think about, is their decreased arousability at night. Right. Are they really hard to wake up in the morning? Do they snore? So that's, a very rare cause in children of nocturnal enuresis is sleep apnea, because kids can get sleep apnea. But, in my career, I've only sent one child for a sleep study, so it's pretty rare for that to occur. But a lot of times, for one of the biggest therapies that I recommend, which is alarm therapy, that's what it targets. Mm-hmm. Alarm therapy is something that can be very frustrating to parents if they don't really understand the purpose of it. So in talking about the etiology, the arousability of the brain, it's not responding to the full bladder signals, and it's not gating it properly through the brainstem. Alarm therapy has been demonstrated in randomized controlled trials as a good therapy for bedwetting, because it's the only therapy that we have that actually targets that issue, which in my mind is the most pervasive and the most difficult issue to correct. Mm-hmm. And that issue is likely why I see teenagers in my clinic with continued wetting. Mm-hmm. So alarm therapy, you can do commercial alarms, which have sensors that can sense when you start to wet, or you can do the cheapest free version, which is set your own alarm. And I usually recommend parents that they set an alarm 3 hours after bedtime and 2 hours before they wake up. And the people who have the most success with this are the parents who lift their kids out of bed. And I tell moms and dads that, man, you're going to be leading a little zombie to the bathroom sometimes. Right. But the whole purpose of it is not to have a dry night. The purpose is to wake up. So when they, pay money for a bed alarm, like a moisture sensing alarm, a lot of them will give up on it because, man, it didn't keep me dry. I still wet. Mm-hmm. But the real victory with it is not being dry. It's waking up, and that the brain wakes up, becomes aroused, and recognizes, hey, the bladder was trying to tell me something. And now I totally understand what was going on. And through that, consistent therapy, the brain starts involving itself in that circuit. Mm-hmm. But it really takes consistency. Right. And the thing about bed alarms that I really like, or by just setting your own alarm, because there's no difference, so you don't have to pay money for a moisture sensing alarm, because there's really no difference between just waking up in the middle of the night versus using the expensive bed alarm. They both work the same way.
And with the same percentage of improvement.
Yeah. And after you stop the therapy, continue to have improvement.
Right.
So there's certain medications that we can give to children that every single one of them, you go back to almost exactly the way you were before, because it doesn't address the root cause of the problem. Right.
Yeah, when I've talked to parents, I'd say that the bedwetting alarms are the only thing we have that really changes the natural history, even though we might argue, do we know the natural history?
Right.
But everything else, it kind of falls back. And so there's that benefit. So describe exactly, so one of the principal treatments, if not the principal treatment I'm hearing you say, is the bedwetting alarm. And that works by arousing the child. And years ago, I went away from, there's two kinds of commercial alarms. I have not used the home idea. I'm intrigued by that. Was the buzzer, and now they have vibrators, and now they have buzzers and vibrators. And years ago, I had lots of people complain, well, the buzzer doesn't work because it wakes up everybody else, but it doesn't wake the child up, giving another hint at how deep these kids are sleeping.
That is the biggest complaint. Wakes everybody else up, doesn't wake up the person it's intended to.
Yeah. So the vibrating units have been more helpful for me, but I've also learned something from you tonight, and that I've always, I think the literature suggests it takes about 3 months, 70% of kids are better, and it's that persistence that makes it work and not at waking kids up, and it's not focusing on the number of bedwetting things. Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting idea I hadn't come up with, which will encourage me to help kids, people stay with it, because it does seem to work if we get people to do it, and we're just stopping too quickly.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's tough because kids need sleep. Yeah. You know, I mean, there are certain things that you have to balance with the health of your children, but and obviously parents need sleep too. You know, I know that as the mom of a 1-year-old, but it's something that you really do have to be very consistent with it.
I want to come back with another question about sleep and bedwetting that comes up a lot. But before we do that, let me remind listeners again, this is Line 1, Your Health Connection, KSKA Anchorage. My guest is Dr. Laura Merriman. We're talking about bedwetting, principally nighttime bedwetting. We're going to talk, we've talked a little bit about daytime incontinence that children have as well. We've talked about the physiology and the anatomy, how things work, the fact that most of this bedwetting at night does not have any physical abnormality that we can find, and has seems a lot to do with getting the message and responding to the message during sleep, and that a lot of these kids who do this are just very, very deep sleepers, and alarm systems are the best treatment. But so if you've got questions or comments, line 1 at alaskapublic.org. We can take your emails over the next 20 minutes or so. Our local number, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. So explain this scenario to you. Dr. Woodard, I've done exactly what you said. My kids don't drink anything before they go to bed. They all after meals they stop. I do everything right, and often before I go to bed at night, they've already wet. So it happens very, very quickly after they go to bed sometimes. Does that mean anything's wrong in particular?
No, not necessarily. You know, I would definitely make sure that, one, they're getting adequate fluid intake throughout the day. Early in the day. Usually I recommend a child have their own water bottle and they fill it 2 or 3 times before 3 p.m. And after 3 p.m., they get water for dinner and no milk, no juice, absolutely no caffeine. Just stick with plain old water for dinner. And much to the chagrin of most of my patients, I recommend that they don't eat dessert, you know, because that extra sugar solute load will also induce more diuresis or more bladder filling. Restrict fluids 3 hours before bedtime. Make sure that your child's not constipated. Constipation is something that, while it's not a magic cure for daytime or nighttime enuresis, it can certainly perpetuate the problem big time, because it really involves those same sort of nerves down there. And make sure they're taking plenty of time when they go to the bathroom before bedtime. Okay, they have to go to the bathroom right before they go to bed, and make sure that they're taking time to empty their bladder and fully relaxing their pelvic floor. Mm-hmm. A lot of kids, especially, you know, the 5-6-year-olds, they get so engaged in other activities, you know, their games, their video games, playing outside, that they want to go to the bathroom and get out as quickly as possible. So they'll use their belly muscles to try and get their bladder to empty quicker. And we call that Valsalva voiding, which is not a good thing. Mm-hmm. You know, you want to let your bladder muscle do its job. And when we pee, physiologically, the first thing that happens is not that the bladder muscle squeezes, but it's that the pelvic floor relaxes. That, you know, when we sit down to pee, we just relax and it magically happens, right? So a lot of times kids can be discoordinated with their bladder relax, or with their pelvic floor relaxation, and basically their bladder is pushing against a obstructed area. That when you talked about smooth muscle and skeletal muscle and cardiac muscle, some of the muscles down in the pelvic floor are skeletal muscle that can actually stay tonically contracted, which is the only muscle in the body that can actually do that, you know, because you can't hold a bicep curl forever, you know?
Yeah,
it'll
right.
actually, it'll fatigue.
Right.
But that's how we stay continent.
Okay.
But kids, when they get discoordinated, they won't empty completely. And so then if you have, you know, if they ate ice cream for dessert, they had milk or juice for dinner, They peed really quickly before they went to bed, and then, man, 30 minutes later, they totally wet the bed. That's probably, you know, there's certain things that we can modulate a little bit better. Another thing that I recommend is also, as far as daytime voiding habits, that they should get to the bathroom every couple of hours or so. And that's going to help them also recognize during the day those full bladder signals that, hey, I do have to go to the bathroom. You know, I give my kids a prescription, and this is your homework, which is to go to the bathroom when mommy and daddy tell you to go. And it's not so much as, you know, Susie, do you have to go to the bathroom? It's, Susie, we're going to go to the bathroom right now. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of all in how you phrase it sometimes.
Another thing that I have noticed, and again, it's very difficult to observational science when you're only having an observation. There's a lot of biases. We don't remember when we're wrong, for example, as one. But it seems to me that we often, as a pediatrician, hear more about bedwetting at night in the summertime here. And I've often rationalized that's because we have very late hours in the summertime. Our kids stay up late, and they often get up a little bit earlier and get going because there's lots to do in the summertime. And that leads to poor sleep hygiene, more deep sleep, and we know a lot of sleep disorders get worse when we're sleep deprived a little bit. Mm-hmm. Make any sense?
Maybe my bias is a little bit opposite.
All right.
Sometimes I find kids who end up staying up late. They do go to the bathroom because they have the sensation to go to the bathroom, so they end up being drier.
Okay.
They are more active outside, so they tend to have they're basically more dehydrated throughout the day, so they're not making as much urine at night.
Okay.
And you don't typically have the same stressors as you do during the school year.
Okay.
That, you know, we talked about the bladder concentrate stress, and it really does.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So stress makes everything worse, and certainly it doesn't help to make kids more stressed about the situation when you're trying to address this problem.
Right. Positive reinforcement is so important. You know, one of the probably the biggest things I leave kids with is that, you know, this, you're not going to be walking across your high school graduation stage with this issue. You know, to be confident that this is something that you can change, but it takes the biggest and the hardest thing is it takes consistency, and it takes some dedication on the part of the child. They've got to want it, you know, and if they're perfectly happy urinating in a pull-up, you know, and I don't have to get out of bed because that's what I've always done, then it's going to be that much more difficult to address.
What are some other treatment options that families may have heard about on the internet, read about, other friends, kids are trying that we should mention?
So medications. So there's different classes of medications that we can try. Probably the most popular one and most pervasive one is called DDAVP or desmopressin. It's the synthetic antidiuretic hormone. So it's a synthetic hormone that actually dries up your bladder. It's just the way you can think about it. So you take it right before bedtime, and it prevents urine from being produced and going to your bladder. So if you don't have anything in your bladder, then obviously you can't wet, right? It's something that I don't necessarily recommend as a first-line therapy, and I don't recommend it certainly as long-term therapy. The reason is because DDAVP doesn't address the root cause necessarily. I think it's really great for sleepovers. I think it's great for going away to camp. I think it's great to use on an as-needed basis when you really want or need to be dry. But studies have shown that once you stop the DDAVP therapy, you generally go back to doing, you know, exactly what you were doing before, because it's not associated a lot of times with the behavioral modifications that you need to achieve during the day or addressing that second cause, which is the decreased brain response to the bladder signaling. The other problem is it has a side effect of hyponatremia, which is decreased sodium in your body, that you always have to counsel children to not drink fluids after they take it. Because if you are retaining all that water in your body, then your sodium levels will go down, and you can get headaches, nausea, vomiting, and at worst, seizures.
Can you tell which kids are going to respond? I guess another question is, do all kids respond who are bedwetters? Do the vast majority of kids who have nocturnal enuresis, does the evidence suggest that they respond to DDAVP? And also, is one method of giving that medication, it comes in nasal spray and tablets, seem to be more effective?
Well, the nasal spray is not generally recommended as much anymore because it's got a longer half-life. Mm-hmm. So it lasts a lot longer in the body. So the tablets are generally considered safer. To which kids will it truly help and which kids not? So most kids, it would help as long as they modulate their fluids throughout the day, like I had suggested before. The thing about it is a hormone, and you're trying to artificially alter your body's water balance. And I tell some families that who may have had an initial good response to it, and then all of a sudden their child starts wetting again, even though they're taking the exact same dose they did before, that it's a lot like the, you know, proverbial Jurassic Park, life will find a way kind of thing. Your body will find a way to overcome that medication, because achieving water balance is more important to your body than drying up your bladder. But most the kids who will have the best response to it are the kids who have a proven nocturnal polyuria, meaning that you would have to measure their urine volumes at night as opposed to their urine volumes during the day. And you find that they tend to urinate more volume at night than during the day. You would definitely have to measure those volumes, though, which is difficult at home.
Do you find that DDAVP works pretty well for you when you use it for these select situations like camping trips or sleepovers?
In general, it does.
Yeah. Here's an email that came in. It keeps on this theme of talking about medications, and we still have a couple more to talk about, but I thought I'd throw this one in because this gentleman's been waiting. It says, my sled dogs, and I know you're not a vet, Dr. Merriman. Here we go. We're in Alaska. Have urinary leakage, mostly girls, he says, girl dogs. He uses a medication called phenylpropanolamine. Hydrochloride is a miracle drug. Are dogs and humans similar? Are you familiar with this medication and any ideas about what's going on here?
Well, I own two gnarly dogs, but I've honestly never heard of that medication.
Yeah.
I will definitely look it up. It's very interesting.
My thought is it may be a drying agent, but I'm not positive either, so I'll have to tell the person who sent in that one we don't know for sure. He does make another comment at the end. Says, I only have a problem when I dream that I'm going to the toilet. Suggestion here is probably an adult who still has some problems. And that's not an uncommon occurrence to hear parents talk about kids talking about they were dreaming they were going to the bathroom.
Yeah. It's because that signal is getting sent up to their frontal lobes, and their frontal lobes is couching that in an experience, you know, that you're in the shower or you're on the toilet or you're swimming. That all of a sudden you're dreaming about Niagara Falls, and then you have to leap out of bed. That's not unusual.
Other medications. We've talked about bladder training or the alarms, so to speak. We've talked about DDAVP, which decreases the amount of urine being made. What else is out there?
More old school medication is imipramine. It's actually an old medication. It's categorized as a tricyclic antidepressant. It's used for other things, but one of the side effects that people noticed is that people tend to wet the bed less. It's an older medication. I don't honestly really ever use this because it's more toxic than DDAVP. You can get mood disturbances, sleep changes with it, but it does work. It works in about a fifth of children in Cochrane's study, which is, you know, a study of all the best possible trials that you've got. About a fifth of children became dry with it. So it is an alternative that generally we use for children who are very refractory to management. Another medication that we use are a class of drugs called anticholinergics that basically you can think of them as bladder muscle relaxants. So the gotta go medication, exactly the same stuff that you see commercials for. Basically what it does is it relaxes the bladder so that hypothetically what's happening is that the bladder capacity is larger and it's not sending those strong signals to the brain or the spinal cord, so it's not triggering it to empty. It's very good for daytime incontinence that's associated with bladder overactivity, but not necessarily for nighttime, unless you have that proven bladder overactivity, which basically requires a really great history physical exam. Not many children have true overactivity of their bladder the way that many adults can. Requires different imaging studies, essentially. So
there are, you said that you infrequently need, and I'd agree that I think most pediatricians we find we infrequently need any studies, but there are ways to tell how the bladder's working and if it's overactive and the size of the bladder and so forth. So those kind of technologies can be done.
Yes. Yeah, it's called urodynamics. Mm-hmm. Urodynamics is something that I do in the office. It's not the most pleasant study because it's, you know, it's synthetically imitating the micturition cycle. Basically what I do is I measure the pressures inside the bladder, which involves a small catheter inside the bladder. I measure the pressures inside the abdomen, which is a small catheter inside in the rectum. Mm-hmm. And I put EMG electrode patches on the bottom and on the belly. And it's just like, you know, the brainwave patches or EKG patches. It sends little signals to my computer screen that tells me how active the pelvic floor is, because the pelvic floor is definitely involved in micturition. And what I do is I fill the bladder very slowly for kids. And I ask them, you know, ask them when they feel like they have to go to the bathroom. So it's kind of like, you know, I sort of have to go to the bathroom, but I'm in the middle of social studies and I can wait until lunch. Or, man, I'm in the middle of social studies, but I'm going to raise my hand and go to in the middle of class, a more strong desire. Or even if I am in the middle of a math test, or my favorite celebrity is standing right there in front of me, I will run to the bathroom right then because I have to go to the bathroom so bad. You know, all those different sensations, and I look to see what the volume of the bladder is. I see what the bladder muscle is doing. I can see if it's contracting, if it's not contracting. I can see if the pelvic floor is contracting to prevent incontinence or if they become incontinent. There's a lot of information we can get from that study.
We haven't talked about children with some disabilities. Commonly now we're seeing kids with neurologic disabilities. More commonly, I think the issue of Down syndrome, autism comes to play. Mm-hmm. What can we tell parents about helping kids learn to become continent in that situation?
I think for kids who are truly autistic, and even for kids with Down syndrome, one of the things that we need to do is focus a lot on chaining. It's something that people use in autism therapies a lot, you know, that you give children a very distinct sequence of events that they need to go through in order to urinate. A lot of those children don't often recognize or respond to those full bladder signals, and some of those children really never will. Mm-hmm. But if you lead them to the bathroom every couple of hours, and sometimes you can pictorially represent that, you know, first I unbutton my pants, and then I pull down my underwear, then I sit down on the toilet, go to the bathroom, and everything's sequenced step by step. Mm-hmm. The biggest issue with some children with autism is that they don't really have any desire to become dry or become continent. So in those cases, we have to manage those children a little bit differently.
Mary, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi, I just wanted to tell you that we had a really successful story with using the alarm system with our child. He's older now, but you know, we had kept saying to him, it's not your fault, it's okay, don't worry about it, we can change the sheets. And we finally went to the pediatrician and talked to them. We were living in another state. And the pediatrician sat down right at his level and looked him in the eye, and she said, the first thing you need to know is this is not your fault. And he just burst into tears. And it was the doctor telling him that finally allowed him to believe it, because he knew it wasn't happening to his friends. And we used the alarm, and we were very diligent about it. And when he went for overnights at other people's house, we let them know what was going on and made allowances for that. And it took several months, but it was very successful, and he was so pleased. And I just remember with all my heart the day he ran up to his pediatrician and said, Dr. Ann, it really worked.
That's wonderful, and that's so good to hear. And that really reinforces that, you know, positive reinforcement is so important. I find a lot of these kids really internalize this.
Right.
And it's such a huge stressor. Yep. That having the confidence that they will overcome this is probably one of the most important things I can leave them with.
Right. And it was just so important that we didn't realize how important it was for the doctor to tell him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had reinforced things, but he just, you know, he was seeking help. And even at that very young age, he was able to make that connection mm-hmm. that this is somebody who specializes, who can help me.
So that's an interesting observation. I've had kids who were thumbsuckers, and that's notoriously hard. I've shown them an open bite in a mirror in my office, and the parents say, "That kid stopped the minute you did that at three, even." You know, and so what's going on there? Why does it take a professional to get kids to, and adults to change, or even adults to change behavior? Sometimes it's fascinating. Any idea?
Well, the only thing I can say is they're so used to us. Well, I hope lots of parents are really positive, but sometimes it's, you know, I think maybe in the kid's head it's just, oh, mom and dad are telling me that, but
right,
just society
right,
telling
right,
that, right?
Right. Did you or your brothers or your husband or his brothers have some bedwetting? Did y'all ever talk about that at home either? That it's just another thing that often seems to help kids feel a little better.
Right, and it didn't happen in my family, but my husband talked to our son about that it had happened to one of his siblings.
Sure.
So,
sure.
Yeah, that seemed to help, too. But the one thing, too, I would encourage parents is this takes some time. We're talking months,
mm-hmm.
and you need to be committed to, you know, helping your kiddo and getting up and missing some sleep. But in the long run, you're going to save yourself a lot of sleep
mm-hmm.
by having a kid who his body just started to recognize. His brain would tell his body, this is about to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very successful. So we recommended it to other people we knew that ran into the issue later on. And they had success stories, too. So I just think it's a wonderful idea.
All right. Thanks for your comments, Mary.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. Bye.
Dr. Merriman, just about in our last minute, I always like to kind of leave listeners with some primary bits of information. We don't retain a lot of what we hear. What do we want people to remember from today's program?
So, first of all, just like what the previous caller had said, that encourage your children to have confidence. Encourage your children to take charge of this. Positive reinforcement is absolutely essential. And they should have knowledge that this is something that a lot of their peers do go through, but it's something that can be managed and something that can be fixed.
Mm-hmm.
I always recommend fluid modulation throughout the day, managing constipation, and alarm therapy. You know, studies have shown that parents who are very consistent with it, who lift their kids out of bed if necessary, their children do achieve continence sooner, and it takes time. Man, it takes time.
Thanks very much for taking the time to be with us and sharing this information.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
My thanks to today's guest, Dr. Laura Merriman. She's an Anchorage pediatric urologist. You can find links to her website at our website, alaskapublic.org. If you'd like to continue this conversation, you can join KSKA on Facebook, where you can also find the links at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also find our Line 1 archives at that same link. Next Monday, our topic is going to be evidence-based medicine and why this has become such an important issue in healthcare. My guest is Dr. Andrew Schwartz. So why not tune into your health and learn more next Monday, July 7th at 2 p.m. Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer at Alaska Public Media. Monica Gokey is our web editor and also audio engineer today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. You guys have a good day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.